Read Like a Word.
About writing about the big things, the big issues, the big topics. We're talking non-fiction. I hope we're talking fact. And we've got a real heavy hitter here on the programme with us in the studio for a change. How will we
have, I know. Well, normally we interview people remotely, don't we, at festivals and things like that, and then feed it into our mindless blathering.
And then we can say what we like about them because they're not here.
Absolutely.
And they don't find out until later.
We've got to be kinder on this one.
He's here in front of us.
Anyway, who the heck are you?
I should say who we are first. So you're listening to We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And with us in the studio is Jamie Cawley, who has been described as the Bill Bryson of faith, of history. And that you can summarise what his books are about in one sentence. Everything you think you know about history or religion is wrong. But luckily, he's here, so he's going to tell
us. Big claim. Hello, Jamie.
Hello, Stephen. Hello, Paul.
Before we get on to all that,
what?
Have you invented anything unusual?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Is there something you know that you're not telling me?
Something to do with chocolate, I seem to remember.
Oh, right, yeah. That used to be my job, was creating new products for a variety of companies. So if you've ever eaten a Cadbury's Boost, that was something that I and a couple of other guys created.
You created the Boost.
Yeah. Forget the religion and all that stuff, mate. He invented the Boost.
We've got the creator of the Boost here.
The Boost.
This is
the Boostmeister.
And also, I detected it was the Boost dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, was there more?
Oh, yeah, there were some other ones, but that was the main chocolate one. There were other paints, like there was Crown Paints did a thing called Solo, which was very successful for a number of years.
Not so tasty.
Now,
not so tasty.
Don't eat paint at home.
No paint eating, please. Okay, but a Boost, that's pretty amazing.
That is pretty good, yeah.
Other people invented things. One of the monkeys invented Tippex, wasn't that right?
His mum did.
Okay, so and not as good, you actually did it. And there was naughty but nice. Who invented that phrase? Was that Salman Rushdie? He wasn't talking about you, was he?
It's very Salman Rushdie, isn't
naughty
it?
But nice.
Well, earlier in his career, when he was doing copywriting.
Oh, okay. I know Hedy Lamarr, the Hollywood actress, invented Bluetooth.
Oh, yeah. Some kind of radar thing.
Yeah. She patented what basically became Bluetooth. Mm. A sort of way of it individually sending signals out so that you can have three or four devices in a room at the same time and they wouldn't all operate each other.
Oh, that is good, but it's not a Boost.
It's not a Boost, no.
And so the more than one type of Boost, did you just set them on the road and then they innovated?
That was really it, yes. It's a long story, which is, I think, probably not what you want to hear about how it came about. Uh-huh. But, yes.
But still, I would have a badge saying, or a T-shirt.
I invented the Boost. Yeah.
And it's ambiguous as well.
Was that the one that Vic and Bob advertised, where it was like it's slightly ripple with a flat underside? I think that was the tagline, wasn't it?
Yep.
Slightly ripple with a flat underside.
Ah, you see, we get the best guests.
We do.
Okay, books then. He wants to talk about books. Okay, so two books in the studio here. The first one was the history book, The Birth of Now, I think I'm right, followed by Beliefs. And the world they have created. I'm reading this upside down.
That's the new one.
Yeah, that's the more recent one. Big topics, huge topics. What's the basic way you go about it?
These are both things I was interested in reading about. The Birth of Now is why the Industrial Revolution, what we call the Industrial Revolution, terrible word because everything else changed. And we're talking about agriculture, transport, finance, even, if you think about it, books. I mean, Jane Austen, the first, real novelist, was at exactly the same period as the Industrial Revolution. Mm. And that's because books became possible, really. I mean, cheap enough, which is quite interesting. They were made out of crunched-up clothing. So what created this sudden change that we're still in the middle of? And the more I looked at it, the more bizarre it became, because if you go back, I was in Knossos in Crete, and you look around, it's 1900 BC, way before the Greeks and so on. And I looked at the paintings, and they're really very modern, very light. Mm. And you think, well, why didn't things go on? What stopped everything progressing? So, and I looked to find out what it was, and nobody's answered that. Here we have what is unquestionably the most important change in history. I mean, before that, for 5,000 years of recorded history, people, you know, had earth floors and shat in the garden.
See, one of the things I noticed about this is people sometimes think of history as a continual progression, a kind of even, things getting better, incrementally improving all the time. But in fact, you're saying that ages ago, there was a big change, and then nothing really much happened. Nothing that significant happened for ages until now.
People don't realise that many societies have had a vision about the way the world went. The Chinese have always seen it as going around in circles, with dynasties being destroyed and then building up new dynasties. The Egyptians and the Greeks, to a very large extent, saw it as going downhill from a golden age to a silver age to the Bronze Age. And you can see that, actually, in Egypt, because the first thing they built were the gigantic pyramids.
Absolutely, yeah.
So this idea that people have is just an idea, and people had different ones. If you look at the period just before the Industrial Revolution, Rome was way ahead of it, and they knew it. That's why we have a Senate in the USA. They were trying to ape a better civilization, a more advanced civilization, with the structure of not only the Senate, but of course the Republican Constitution was copied from Rome.
And slavery. Maybe not copy.
Well, and slavery as well. But so you can actually see that about 1760 or the American Revolution a bit later, they were well aware of the fact they weren't ahead. They had done the odd thing of discovering America, which, of course, Romans never had. But in fact, they were still stuck where they were. You know, empires had gone and come, and peaceful times had happened, and then they'd been fallen to bits. I mean, the Dark Ages. How can anyone look at the Dark Ages of Europe and say there was progress upwards when you came from, you know, the way that the aqueducts had decayed, Bath, the city of Bath, had fallen into disrepair, and it had definitely gone downhill in some sense of civilization.
I mean, that does almost smack of sort of cyclic, doesn't it? You know, because we have seemed to have gone up and up and then down, down, down and up and up. I get a horrible suspicion we're on a bit of a down at the moment.
Do you think, are we on a down?
I don't know.
As someone who's particularly looked into this, because people are saying, you know, deaths in wars overall are down, life expectancy is increasing, kind of lots of good things and statistically are happening. However, what do you think?
I mean, what can I say? I mean, the number of starving is collapsing. The millennium targets, which were set up in 2000, were achieved in half the time in terms of the disappearance of hunger and disease. Now, it's by no means all gone, but it is halved.
But okay, but is that, to be callous, a bit boring? So when we're thinking about history, so for thousands of years, people are still going around on horses. Hey, where's the big change? So, okay, people aren't starving to death, but where's my jetpack?
Where's my jetpack? It's all about you, isn't it? It's all about you.
Well, when you've got a phone, which sits there and guides you to where you want to go, calls up your friends, tells you what you're doing during the course of the day, plays podcasts into your ear, and I mean, almost miraculous. As somebody, and the video phone, which was, you know, I remember in Thunderbirds they had video phones, and it was all terribly exciting.
They basically had iWatches, didn't they? They had Apple Watches, basically. Yeah.
But I mean, now we just pick it up, and not only do we phone people and video phone people, we do it for free.
Is it kind of the ubiquity of it and the kind of boringness of it is what makes it, we don't realise how special it is.
People take it for granted very quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a whole joke about, you know, you no sooner get this machine which does the video phone and you're going, damn Wi-Fi! You know, why can't it get a bit faster? Rather than saying this is miraculous.
Maybe we would all be bored of jetpacks now.
Well, how do you go about writing? So that's kind of a bit of the theory behind it. How do you write something like that? You've written, I was going to say we've both written fiction, which is true, we have done. Steve,
I've written non-fiction.
I've written non-fiction as well. In fact, Steve's done everything. So, but you're writing a big picture thing. How do you go about that? It seems like daunting. Do you take it too superficially, or how do you not get lost in details? Or,
well, the challenge is keeping it down, throwing stuff out. I mean, in writing the other book, which is about beliefs, there's a section on Christianity, which is down to 50 pages, start and finish. Now, there's a wonderful book by Dermot McCulloch called The History of Christianity, and it's 1,100 pages. And I've got it down to 50.
He's an awful waffler, isn't he? Padding gone mad.
I think 50 pages is a bit much.
Well, Islam only 30, so well, there you go, communism likewise. Yeah. It's really very what this issue of trying to edit down, and that's why when we come to the Industrial Revolution, there are so many possible causes and shapes and forms and so many candidates. Was it to do with coal? Was it to do with navigation, communication? Was it to do with all the, you know, the ideas of the rule of law or something like that? And you absolutely have to cut down. And that's the difficult bit, the editing. Mm. And, you know, both books were at least, well, I would think approximately 10 times as long at one point or another, and just go through ruthlessly.
One thing that I like about The Birth of Now, and maybe it's something to do with how it's created, is that I suppose a lot of history, you look at the outcome and think what led to it, and whatever happened before it, you think, oh, well, that inevitably led to this because it happened, so it was always going to happen. Whereas you've kind of looked at things and said, well, why didn't it happen in other places? So if the Industrial Revolution, I think, happened England, Ulster, and Wallonia.
Belgium.
So it happened in those three places. So people think, well, it was always going to happen there, and these are the reasons why. Whereas you've taken a different approach and said, well, a lot of those reasons were present at other times in other parts of the world. So how come it didn't happen then? Can we really see that generally history is a bit lazy, do you think? So you've taken a different approach to it.
I was very lucky because, as you know, Paul, The Birth of Now is written in Shanghai, in the Yangtze Delta, and which is now at the end of its last stage of its own industrial revolution. And you're sitting there thinking, well, this has just happened now. And it clearly could happen. There is coal just up the way. The navigation is superb, blah, blah, blah.
And they had stable states. And
yes, there was a very early stable state. Look what Marco Polo thought of it. All tremendous, you know, 1250. And so I was in a position where I was forced to confront this thing. It's only happening now in Shanghai. It's happening very successfully. But why didn't that happen at the end of the Song Dynasty? In about 900, they were cooking on gas, quite literally. They were using gas. The steel output of China was greater than any time up until the Industrial Revolution was really going on its way in 1850. They were very literate, civilised. They had paper money, that sort of thing. So I was actually forced into the position of trying to answer that question.
Is it something to do with mindset? Because I mean, if we look back to the Industrial Revolution and we look at the Victorians, they did seem to think that they could do anything. I mean, I've read accounts of where there were genuine discussions in Parliament about straightening the Thames. There were genuine discussions about, I mean, look at the Great Exhibition of 1851, you know, and building that huge Crystal Palace in a matter of sort of a year, throwing this extraordinary thing up, and it generated so much money, so much income, that paid for the whole of South Kensington. All those museums and places of learning were paid for by this. It just seemed that they thought, of course we can do this.
But that was a consequence, I feel, of what they'd already done, not a cause.
Oh, okay.
And it's the same in China. I mean, I've now moved to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong, you can drive 52 kilometres across the Pearl Estuary, 52 kilometres on a bridge tunnel. And there was a problem. They wanted to build a bridge so that the ships could go underneath it up the Pearl River, but that would have been too high masts near Hong Kong Airport. So they just built a tunnel in the middle, so rather than a bridge. And that's because they've done it all. There's this huge self-confidence that drives everything. And I think the British self-confidence went on until probably the First World War.
Oh, it did,
skew into that.
So it's interesting, because you were saying they had this great self-confidence. You're saying, well, actually, that was a consequence rather than a cause. I suppose people have comforting national myths that it's the British spirit that lets us do this, and other countries may well do the same thing. So I often see people talking about perfectly normal things, saying, oh, well, that's being British. I think everyone does that.
Well, America was very much like that in the 60s, with Kennedy standing and saying, we're going to put a man on the moon, and bang, they did.
And they did, yeah.
But again, that was when you look at that was as towards the end of a period when they had just done everything.
They had
all the cars in the world and all the money in the world and everything. The interesting thing about the Industrial Revolution, in part, is it was coincidental with the last war the British lost, which was the American War of Independence. So,
were we licking our wounds, trying to make ourselves feel better? Was it that, maybe?
What's
the answer?
I mean, I don't know. Are we allowed to know what the answer is, or does that kind of spoil? Spoiler, is it buy the book, read the book, and you'll find out? Because there are answers.
Yeah.
Satisfyingly, it's not one of these things, oh, well, we'll make up your own mind, we'll never know. No, there are specific answers and reasons why.
I remember when there was one of those wonderful moments, because I think I'm happy to sort of put forward ideas, but I remember this fantastic moment when I had in my head, yeah, the answer is this. And when you go on the internet and you find the proof, that this is the moment feeling. You go, God, good grief, that I'm right. Which is remarkable.
Okay, so what was it then? Just to set it up a little bit, there's something you have on the first page of The Birth of Now, and it says, in 1870, more than 4,000 years after it was built, the Great Pyramid at Giza in Egypt was still the world's tallest man-made structure. And when was it built?
2,500 BC.
Okay, so it's been, you know, 4,000 years, more than 4,000 years. So by 2010, only 140 years later, there were more than 10,000 buildings taller than the Great Pyramid. This book is about what caused this change and what will change next. So clearly, stuff had been trundling along, and then all of a sudden, kapow, you know, bang, a big change. And it was kind of the Industrial Revolution that we've said about where it was.
That's a shorthand.
England, Northern Ireland, Belgium. So why then?
Okay. There are two causes. One was the background necessity. And I came to this because if you look at Read Jane Austen, which everyone should, they all talk about the money in the funds. And the government was able to borrow huge sums of money at 3.5% or 4% to fund the wars that were more or less continuous. The French government couldn't borrow anything. They had to pay 18% and promise the title of nobility to anyone who'd lend them money. Now, and you're thinking, well, why is this? And that made a huge difference, because then the French government fell catastrophically into the French Revolution. And the reason was that one day the king could get up and go, don't feel like paying the debts anymore. Whereas in England, we had an oligarchy by that point, and the people who were lending the money were in government, or their uncles, or their aunts, or the whatever. And they were going to pay that money back because it was their money. And that makes you think, hang on a moment, what we've got in England is the rule of law, and Scotland, and slightly lesser extent Ireland at the time, well, quite a lot less, actually, was the rule of law. That we'd chucked out a few kings who'd got a bit overmighty, and what had settled down was that if you invested some money in something and it turned out well, you could get it back. You still can't do that in a lot of third world countries. Maybe that's why they're third world. Okay, so first you've got to have the rule of law, the idea that you can put money in and you can get money back. And that led directly to the second thing, which is this ability to borrow money. And about 1850, they came up with this idea of the consol. Now, what happened then is that people, instead of, you know, keeping money by gold and burying it and having candelabras on the side, they lent it to the government. The government then spent it. People got the money back because they were the entrepreneurs. And then they put the money back in the consol, so the government then spent it.
So they were the dragons of their day.
Indeed. Yeah. And the eureka moment was when I discovered that the UK government debt in 1700... was £12 million, and in 1816 it was £750 million. 12 million to £750 million. That money had gone in, been spent mostly on naval supplies, rope, cordage, gunpowder. Another thing that was great advantage, because a lot of money spent on armies was spent abroad in previous times, but this was largely spent at home on the navy, and this just went round and round and round. So suddenly we found a way of creating vast sums of money. And I talk in the book about the problems earlier on that people have always had, not enough money. And the reason for that is when terms get scarce, people hide their gold and suddenly there's not enough to exchange. So it was really those two things which created this momentum. It's rather crude and people don't like talking about money.
So there were the other things that people talk about, like the navigable waterways, coal, stability. Lots of places had those at lots of different times. Yes. But the X factors that made it kick off were these.
Those availability of money. Yeah. And the Dutch damn near did it before us, before the Brits. They got very, very close. But then unfortunately, they got peace. which blew everything. Yeah, I know, it was a terrible. So suddenly, instead of borrowing money and spending it, they stopped borrowing money and spending it. And the Dutch economy just went, poo, and they never understood what had happened to it. What previously they'd been way the richest people in the world, and you know, Rembrandt had flourished.
And Dutch East India Company. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
And suddenly it just went away, because they were no longer borrowing money and spending it. I'm not sure what the lesson is for now, and I don't want to draw any.
I have a feeling if I borrow money and spend it, I don't get any richer.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that. It doesn't work for individuals, does it?
But maybe if you took over the country.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Nice little coup.
There's, as well as the big picture stuff, there are lots of interesting little nuggets and diversions in this. I think you might like this one. No, I'm going to refer to a note here.
Oh, please do.
You talk about printing, and you know, people talk about Gutenberg and printing in Europe, but China and Japan had that already. But anyway, never mind about all that. So you talk about the mass market for print was driven by large-scale sales of small, cheap, scandalous popular works, parts of the Bible or pamphlets. And this was sold at street corners by leery types who could avoid the authorities by running off. And then so that's where we derive the term for the more respectable type of bookseller, a stationer, because they had fixed stationary premises. And they weren't able to sell the subversive, libelous, pornographic pamphlets that street corner sellers could.
It's like the Penny Dreadfuls and this sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also like the internet. I mean, the analogies just hit one, because suddenly there was complete no control at all, and people were producing stuff that was really very scandalous and much of it totally untrue. And that also undoubtedly kicked the Reformation into existence. And 200 years of war, which followed as the Protestants and the Catholics went at it. And that was pretty much driven by this sudden information burst. And the analogies are so powerful now, because they then had to license print. And, you know, now if you print anything, it must have the publisher's name and address on it and things like that. And is that going to happen with the internet? It looks like it's going that way.
It's also fake news of its time, wasn't it?
Also getting spelling mistakes. So, you know, is it stationary or stationery? In fact, they're the same thing.
Well, they are, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, this they give a different spelling too.
So this whole thing, it derives from people who weren't selling porn. Yes, and now people have been penalised at primary school for getting these two words mixed up, whereas in fact they really are the same thing.
There you go. Yeah. And that's an extraordinary thing. But certainly there was this sort of underground sharing of information, as you say. It was rather like the sort of dark net of its day, I suppose, and the fact that all this stuff was going on rather salaciously, sort of under the covers and on the street corners, and the penny dreadfuls and things like this. But it did also lead to an increase in literacy as well, and there was a lot of people who used that, if you want to call it, social network for the better. I mean, it's because of that we've got Sweeney Todd. It's because of that we've got Dickens.
You're absolutely right. I mean,
so it had a good side as well.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, it spread information and, as you say, encouraged people who were literate. I mean, a lot of the pamphlets were read out by people in sort of pubs and so on. So there's another lovely irony I just wanted to mention.
Please
do. And that is that what got the printing going in Europe was indulgences.
Oh, yeah.
They had to be printed. Mm. I mean, because, you know, you couldn't just write out a, you know, 50 years off purgatory in writing, because it wouldn't have any kind of authority, would it? So it was the need to print indulgences. Gutenberg got his first money from printing mass-producing.
So these are vouchers, for people who might not be familiar with it, I suppose they're for Catholics back in the day. So it's a voucher. You can buy a voucher, a printed voucher that says that, well, if you're going to hell, you're doomed, you're going to hell, or you might go straight to heaven. But most people, they thought they would go to an interim place, purgatory, where they'd be suffering for, I don't know, thousands of years until they finally paid their debt to God and got promoted to heaven. So this would give you time off torture and purgatory after you're dead. And you could buy it. I'll get 50 years off my torment after I'm dead. Crazy to think about
That's
it.
Extraordinary.
Well, and that the sales of those funded the wonderful St. Peter's in Rome, which cost a lot of money, but also got everyone into the printing business, and that then blew apart the Universal Church in Law of Unintended Consequences, big time.
But I do find it. I do also find it very interesting about the lowest common denominator. That if you look at any new form of mass communication, the thing that always seems to give it a kickstart is filth, isn't it? It's always salacious. It's like, you know, it was the pornographic prints back in the day of Hogarth. It was these penny dreadfuls, you know, when video came along, it was VHS videos being able to do this. And now, of course, it's the internet. The internet has sort of, it's grown to the size it is because mostly of gossip, rumour and pornography. It's extraordinary how the lowest common denominator seems to drive the rise of these things and success of these things.
Going back to the stationers and the non-stationary ones standing in the street flogging stuff, so you do kind of innovative ways of selling your stuff or spreading what you do. Can you imagine, I don't know, standing on the street with your books, hawking them?
Yeah.
I can't imagine you doing that.
I'd give it a go. But the point
is book signings.
Yeah. But you've got to attract the reader, so you want that headline, don't you? You want that little bit of salacious gossip, that little bit of crudity that's going to make someone come over and buy it.
You could have multiple covers. Yeah, you could have a dozen.
Yeah, it's clickbait.
A dozen different covers, the same book inside, just dust jackets, depending on then, you know, the person walking past and say, oh yeah, this will interest you. And they go,
Just yesterday, a well-known tabloid newspaper, the front page headline in large letters was drinking one glass of fruit juice a day can give you cancer. You know, the same thing's still going on. It's still going on right now. They're trying to get people to go, oh, what's that about? You know. Yeah, it was the clickbait of its day.
I think I might try and sell my books with multiple covers, but the same book inside and see what works. if anything works. Okay, what about, book number two then. We've done history.
We've done the whole of human history now. And
oh, wait, no, the one thing we didn't do was what's happening next?
Well, that's what this does is it changes one's view of history. As you discussed at the start, people have this view of the gentle rise of history. And I think I try and dismiss this and say nothing happened, bang, suddenly everything happens. And it's in 250 years ago. So it's all changing much, much faster than people think. There are a number of things which would indicate that this is going to stop.
Ah.
And that's quite complicated to explain, but some things are unimprovable.
You see, you said that's quite complicated to explain. He kind of looked at us and thought, I'll give it a go.
To people like you. I'll,
there might be people listening who'll get this. I'll keep them in mind.
I get what you mean. There are some things that are unimprovable. All you can do is just tweak it.
Yeah, if you've got good air conditioning, great temperature, you can't get it better. I mean, it's good. But also, I have a theory that we're running out of creative space. Not natural resources, but creative space. So that you can see this in, for example, music. The technology gives you a new kind of music, so that when they're able to keep instruments in tune, you could have lots of them playing at the same time. The symphony arrived. Bach couldn't write symphonies because they couldn't keep his instruments in tune for that long. So then you get the symphonies. Okay, then you get amplification. Amplification. I mean, you couldn't have possibly talk about rock and roll without amplification. So that suddenly releases a whole new creative buzz. But then you get to the end of all that, which is when you can actually make any sound you want, any time you want. Where do you go? And you can see this happening. I mean, natural history programmes, exactly the same thing. The new technologies enable tiny cameras and so on, enable new things. But there's only one world. And, you know, you're using it up, like mining out a resource very, very quickly. So I can see that there's going to be a great problem. If you look at even genres like, say, sitcom, started off with I Love Lucy in the 1950s, and they diverted this way and that way and the other way. And arguably, the genre is getting mined out.
Oh, it's pretty much dead now. I mean, yeah. I speak to a lot of comedians, and they're all saying the same thing, that sitcom is pretty dead now. I mean, the thing that seems to have sort of replaced it is the comedy drama, where you've actually got a sort of a much longer cycle story that has an element of comedy running through it. That seems to have taken over. But yeah, there's very few sitcoms still around. There's still a hankering for it from sort of some of the old guard. I mean, nothing else can explain the success of Mrs. Brown's Boys and things like this. You know, but it's a, but there is still a hankering back for the old days of sitcom. And people love to watch the reruns, but in terms of writing new sitcoms, very difficult.
Your creative
very
space difficult. Is used. It's yeah. like if you try and write a new Beethoven symphony now, you can. It's just a variation, though, on what he and Brahms did and so on. It's not. I'm sure it'd be a nice noise, but it's just not that interesting. And the same with, say, sitcoms. Is it, if you try and avoid everything from The Big Bang Theory to Porridge, you're left with, well, where do I go now? That's going to be different.
Mm.
Now, if you take that through an awful lot of art and things like sport, Olympic records, and that kind of thing, as well as the fact that we get to, you know, if you're comfortable and you're living in a nice house and you've got personal transport, yeah, you can improve it. It can go from petrol to electric, but it's still personal transport and that kind of thing. And when it's self-driving and you've got entertainment within it, it's going to be very difficult. Only marginal improvements. So we can see a point when it's kind of going to grind to a halt, where you get things that are just all of them either worked out and repeated, or they're just fine, thank you. You can't get better than that.
So we have to modify humans. Maybe that's the next thing.
Well, do you know, it's funny because I was, a couple of years ago, I was working on a project. It didn't actually go anywhere. It came out of something I was doing when I was working on QI, where I'd been looking at the fact, I interviewed the person who ran the last Knackers yard in Britain. And he was saying the arrival of the motor car basically changed the entire way of life for a huge chunk of the population, because up until that point there had been people who had bred horses, who had trained horses, who'd built carriages, who'd done all these things, right up and including the knacker, who at the end of the day would take your dead horse in and would recycle the horse into leather and bone that could be used for the handles of knives and glue and all these other things that it was done for. Whereas now, you know, if little Fiona's pony dies, you've got to get a permit and get it incinerated in an appropriate place. But the point is, a huge upheaval to the whole of the country because of this one change in technology. My brother went through something similar. My brother was a quite a successful photographer, and then digital photography came along, and suddenly now Uncle Eric and his DSLR can go to the wedding, take 500 photographs, of which 50 by accident are pretty good. So his wedding photography jobs just dried up. So he then retrained as a photography teacher and taught at university. And then people stopped coming on those courses because now what they wanted was training on how to fix the photographs post. So now he teaches Photoshop. And it's funny that every so often these changes happen in society and it affects a huge number of people. But all that happens is we just move from a slightly different discipline to the one before. You know, the people who were riding around in the cabs, you know, the sort of, you know, your standard cabs clip-clop around London, your hansom cabs, then became the taxi drivers with the arrival of the automobile. You know, it's, as you say, it doesn't change things fundamentally, it's just that you move into a slightly different sphere of work.
But what I think, and this is a genuine worry, is that when people get less real, pungent things to worry about, when the wars have gone away, they get hissy and spiteful and more aggressive to each other. I think one of the most interesting things now is to look at, in 1945, the USA did the most magnanimous thing, I think, has ever been done by any country, when Douglas MacArthur came into the Tokyo Bay and the Emperor Hirohito was there. He thought he was going to be shot there and then. And MacArthur said, we will rebuild you. Mm. This was a country that attacked without warning and had fought without any kind of constraint. And they did that. That's fantastic, amazing thing to do. And now you get spitty, nasty caravans of refugees approaching. Everyone going, you know, and you're thinking, well, that, how can that be the same country? How can that be the same society? And it does seem somehow that when people don't have big things to worry about, they think what a tick their neighbour is instead.
It's kind of true. I mean, when the, you know, there were people on the docks cheering when the first shiploads of people came in from the Caribbean and from the far, from the Asian subcontinent to come and work in our factories. There were people cheering as they arrived. You know, now look how it's changed. That's an interesting idea that if we haven't got anything really serious to worry ourselves, we turn in and start eating ourselves. That's an interesting idea.
Who's that dystopian writer? That's one of his themes. He's written a lot.
Well, Orwell thought that what kept people together was the eternal war that was going on, that enabled control. But it's certainly arguable that we are in a state at the moment where there is no credible threat life in Western Europe or the USA that has any meaning. And so people sort of create it.
J.G. Ballard, he's the person who people are descending into spiteful snidiness, just as you're describing. I think it was Supercan, maybe it was that, or one of his people in kind of gated communities. So burglaries happen, assaults happen, brings people together. They start socialising, playing tennis tournaments, this sort of thing. And it's all deliberately manufactured to have an external threat and their lives become much happier.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the people we need to go
alien invasion. I think if we had a good alien invasion, there'd be no more racism, there'd be no more sexism. It would be us against them.
Us against the orange people.
It would certainly make us pull together in some
Absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it would be, actually, I don't know, because they would probably land in America. They always do. So we'd
yes,
be like, the Americans have been attacked by aliens again.
District 9, they landed in South Africa.
Yeah, okay, with that exception.
Can you imagine them saying, take me to Sue Leader, and then let me try...
Actually, we're not sure who it is.
You're kidding, guys. Come on. Yeah. Take us to your real leader. Yeah.
I hear that we wouldn't know. Let's get on to book two then, which is called Beliefs. Having done the history of the world, we're now on Beliefs.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, it came about because I wanted to understand major religions fairly simply. And I looked for short introductions. What is polytheism? What is Christianity? What is Judaism? What is Islam, Buddhism, and so on? How do these things, you know, what are the fundamentals? Come on, just a quick one. Not, you know, here are the words of their ceremonies. And to that, it became apparent that you have the modern beliefs, which are not so God-centric, but then nor is Buddhism, which are nationalism, which was created in 1792, communism, which came and went, quite interestingly, and... environmentalism, which is a Puritan, repent now for the end of the world is at hand.
So interesting. So definition of a belief then, it doesn't, I suppose I think of it, and it's not universally true, but I think of a religion or a faith or a belief as having some supernatural element to it.
Buddhism doesn't, does it? There's no God in Buddhism.
Well, if you think about nationalism, that has a supernatural element. The spirit of the nation, you know, you can go on about that, and people do. Communism certainly had, you know, the inevitability, the spirit of history, that sort of thing. Marx is very keen on that. And if you look at environmentalism, you've got Gaia, and those kind of things. There is that sense that the world will get its revenge on these wicked, you know, people, careless people.
Despoiling the earth.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's interesting.
So it's very much, in the old days it was the Puritans, you know, who you should worship God more, whereas now we should pay more attention to nature. Now, it has a very strong spiritual or supernatural.
So did you approach this with a spirit of, gosh, isn't religion great? Aren't beliefs wonderful? I want to celebrate and have a joyous embrace of it. Or were you approaching it with a sort of the... these charlatans must be exposed for
what
they are.
That's exactly what I wanted to avoid. I just want to say, it's impossible. I want to say, here is a description of how they come about, what they believe. And in the middle of it, you suddenly discover these extraordinary things. Mm. I mean, two Gospels list out Jesus's brothers. Now, this is not commonly talked about. But he had four brothers, according to the Gospels of Mark and Matthew. And the oldest brother, James, took over the church when he was killed. And you think, well, that's a bit of a surprise. Hadn't noticed that before.
And their descendants are still around now.
Yeah, wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. So there were lots of those things which were really unexpected. For example, Judaism, yeah, it's all about Israel and Judah and all that kind of thing. You then find out when you look at it that both the Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible, and the Talmud, which is the sort of one that came afterwards, that's all really the Jewish core, were both written in Babylon. Hmm. Nowhere near Jerusalem and all that. Oh, well, that's, again, interesting. And in the middle of it, I discovered that Socrates was illiterate. That was a surprise. Explain why you're such a god-awful old bore. but you know, there were lots of these things that cropped up that were quite amusing, that when you actually study these things. And for example, going on to the later ones, the first name for the Communist Manifesto was the Communist Confession of Faith.
Oh.
They were very conscious that they were copying a religion. Indeed, the word manifesto was always used in religious context beforehand. Mm. It was the first one. So you can, and again, if you want to talk about nationalism, which came about after they chopped the king's head off in France, and then there was a question, well, so what are we fighting for, guys, you know? Why do we say Bordeaux must join us on our side to fight against us? So they invented this idea of the nation, the citoyen in France, and they saw the need for religion. You remember Robespierre produced the service of the universal spirit or something?
Yeah, that's right.
But in fact, they'd found one in nationalism that was, you know, the citoyen de France is going to be this new thing, this nation, which didn't speak all French by any means. I mean, the Bretons and Basques and Flemings.
What are the ones down south?
The Languedoc.
Yes, the Languedoc. They spoke Occitan, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah.
And they then spread this idea that, I mean, for example, the flag of Italy was chosen by Napoleon, which, you know, just one slight variation. And they decided that Italy was going to be a nation. It hadn't been a nation at any point, ever. And the same with the Holy Roman Empire. There was going to be a big chunk of it called Germany, which is quite amusing because the Germans were actually a tribe that lived in Belgium, you know, the way things are. But Tacitus got things a bit muddled up, so, you know, that the Germans are, in fact, now people who aren't Belgian but actually live not far.
That's away. Right. America had Indians, so yeah, why not? You know, it's the same thing. It's all down to bad documentation. Yeah. We're just discussing the area of when religion kind of gets replaced, when a god gets replaced by another strong belief. I suppose you can see this to some degree in America, which although it's a very Christian country anyway, but their allegiance to the flag is a very strong totem, isn't it? I mean, there's a flag hanging outside almost every house. That's a very interesting thing. They think of America almost as a figurehead, don't they?
Yeah, it's a kind of disappointment because nationalism said that these different kinds of peoples called nations. And each one should have a bit of land because they can't get on together. And that has created, as you know, the bloodbaths of the last century as people were shifted across things and the First World War was this challenge. But all this has made nonsense because they all live together very happily in the USA and indeed in Australia. You know, you've got Germans living next door to Poles, living next door to Jews, living next door to whoever, you know, Mexicans, I don't know. And so the theory of nationalism is wrong, but they're rebuilding it, you know, the same thing.
So this is kind of a harking back maybe to a benign view of empire, not so much empire of Africa and Asia, but I'm thinking more like the Ottoman Empire. So pieces of land that were linked, or the Austro-Hungarian Empire maybe. So you have lots of different
even the
national
Roman
groups.
Empire, the Roman Empire, just sort of great chunks of Europe, parts of Africa, the whole lot. It all came under Rome, didn't it?
So you could have, to take a very benign view of it, people coexisting, cooperating, nationalism isn't really a big
deal. Well, what's the difference between the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Habsburg Empire and the European Union? I mean, there's not a lot of difference in principle. I mean, one's obviously a monarchy and the other one's... it's kind of democracy. It doesn't work terribly well, but they contradict nationalism, both of them, because they say that there is no such thing as a nation that is different. I mean, racism is only nationalism without a country, and yet nationalism is respectable.
That's a good quote.
But there are other quirks. During the 19th century, it was all about building countries up, like Italy and Germany, by sticking them together. From little principalities. 20th century, exact opposite. You know, break them off. Ireland, Scotland, Catalonia, whatever. Suddenly that's the thing that's going to result in better rule.
General happiness, yeah. Well, having looked at lots of them, are there any that appeal to you more than others? Any of these faiths?
You're not asking what's the best faith, are you?
We
are not going to
start... I am going to say, what's the best faith?
We are not going to start a holy war.
In theory, Islam is very clear and very simple and very benign.
In theory. Like so many
and things. It's really weird because you've got this great religion which is simple. This is what God says. Here it is written down. And it's quite nice what is written down by and large. And there was this great civilization built on it. And then, on the other hand, you got preaching you know, repression in the most extraordinary way, which just goes to show that you can actually make up anything as you go along.
But is it? It's not even interpretation, is it? It's them saying, no, this is the way you do it. I've decided it. Yeah. So it's almost as if they've superseded the word of their God to say, no, God doesn't quite get it right there. It should be done this way instead, which is extraordinary.
There's virtually nothing that I haven't found some Christian sect promoting in the past.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The slaughter your neighbour was quite, you know, the Crusades were very much on that.
It was a popular one, yeah.
Yep. And then it's now love your neighbour. And then, you know, there's, apart from, you know, from sex, which has always been, Christianity, for some reason, has always been against sex. Hmm. But with that exception, there's every possible action and behaviour, from Puritans sitting in plain buildings to the glories of Gothic Baroque, that really made things bright and with hundreds of saints and so on. So this is one of the complications of the religion, is that actually its interpretation can mean anything. And with Islam, you've got this very simple belief, which is, you know, awfully twisted in a relatively small number of cases, let's hope.
What about Sikhs? They all struck me as quite sensible, almost not a faith at all, because the supernatural element of it seemed almost kind of tacked on in a token way. I don't mean that in an offensive, derogatory way to any Sikhs listening. I mean it in a complimentary way, actually. It seemed a kind of an extremely sane, humanist way of dealing with people, with not so much of the magic accoutrements and furniture.
Well, I don't unfortunately deal with the Sikhs. I only do the top 10. There are surprisingly few Sikhs around. There are only about 13 million of them, which, well, you know, surprised me.
Sorry, Sikhs, you don't make it in.
Yeah, well, that's right. And it's only because they had historically, that they wouldn't be considered part of Hinduism, I think, mainly because they fought against many people. So in the end, it's really only for the people of the Punjab. So it's not really it's more about behaviour and so on. And I agree with you. I was at a Gurdwara in Delhi last year, where they feed 30,000 people a day. I couldn't believe it. And we were taken all the way through. It was very inspiring. As they would do 600 people at a time, 50 times a day, all free, no questions.
Oh, yeah, no converting associated with it. Not like taking the soup.
No, and you just thought, well, this is undoubtedly good.
Hmm.
And it was terrific because it brought, obviously, the Sikh community together.
Oh, well, tell us some weird things that you discovered, because I like the kind of the quirky sides of stuff you come up with. But I have not got a book in front of me, so you'll have to dig them out yourself.
Oh, Karl Marx, for example, had an illegitimate child via his servant, who was given to his wife, Jenny von Westphalen, by her mother, and was never paid. She was a slave. And then he got her pregnant, so he had his illegitimate boy.
Was that Groucho?
that was dear old Karl. Not only that, he boasted of her aristocratic background.
Really?
Yep, and how much money he made on the stock market.
Good Lord.
What a...
Yeah, absolutely.
Priceless.
I know.
He kept going by his dear old friend Engels on the profits of that he made from his cloth works in Manchester. That wasn't, of course, living off the back of the proletariat at all. No, they were intellectuals. So I've always had a fairly low opinion of dear old Karl. I think he's a perfectly horrid man.
Here was a bit that I quite like. So I'm just opening at random. This is from the Christianity bit. And so the introductory paragraph to the one I like is saying, Christianity takes as its central story the short period of Jewish revival preaching of a man called Yeshua before his execution in around 30 CE, Common Era?
Common Era, yeah.
And his subsequent brief reappearance to his followers. Right, so Yeshua was the name of the person we call Jesus, the same name as the Old Testament prophet we call Joshua. Over time, this name was slowly changed in translations into Jesus, because the Greeks have no letter for the sh sound. So it became an S or a sigma. And they couldn't say the wa sound, is it?
Yeah.
The UA. So that became a U, changing Yeshua to Yesu.
Yesu.
Yesu. Yesu, yeah. Or Yesu. Jesu. pronounced Jesu. To fit Greek and Latin grammar, a final S was sometimes added, which became fixed in English translations, changing it to Jesus. And then English changed the pronunciation of the ye in Jesus from ye to G, arriving at the name we use now, Jesus. So things that you think are set in stone are clearly quite adaptable.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the thing I always find quite extraordinary as well is when you find people sort of, when you hear some people who are very anti-Semitic and claim to be very strongly Christian, I can't square that in my head, because I'm not a person of faith myself, but Jesus was a Jew. I can't quite get how they don't see that. You know, it's a...
One of the things that amused me, sorry, just to connect, was I was interested to know how the Old Testament was selected. Because it was originally just separate scrolls, right? And they were all stuck together. Why those scrolls? Now, obviously, some were central and important. But there are lots like the Song of Solomon, which is all about, you know, sex, frankly.
Of course, yeah.
Which seems a bit odd to include. And I found out that it was decided by a fellow called Origen. And he was the guy, there was supposed to be the Septuagint, which were translated by a divinely inspired 70 scholars. But no one knew what was in the Septuagint until Origen told everyone what was in the Septuagint. And Origen was an odd fish. And by odd fish, I mean he castrated himself.
That's pretty odd.
Which is odd. It was also illegal at the time, which is kind of surprising that you were not allowed to castrate yourself.
At least of my worries that someone was going to nick me over it.
And also that it was so prevalent that they felt the need to institute a law specifically against it. Himself,
and he gave the reason was to disarm the tempter. That was his words.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And you think, well, that's really extreme.
It is really.
And why? Why did he think, and this was in just before 200, 2nd century AD, why did he think that sex was so bad? I mean, you know,
good point.
I mean, it goes back to that's what the fall of man and all that kind of stuff. But it is very interesting. And that he was the guy who decided to put this stuff in the Old Testament. And he thought that the Song of Solomon, which has got lots of stuff about how thy twin breasts are as young fawns in the dawn, or where's that general effect?
Well, I didn't want to say, but indeed they are glorious.
And this shows God's love for his church, he said. You know, well, Origen, you know, it's a cracker you got there.
Yeah, bit of a jump, that one, but
we've got two, but there's a third one in the works, a third book in the works. Because, you know, you couldn't just stop at History of the World, Religion Explained. What's next?
Oh, and this is the most arrogant book you can possibly imagine.
Are you declaring yourself as God?
No. It's called Escaping the Circular Firing Squad. And... it's about the only way you can escape.
It's about Brexit.
It's about how you can. The only way to escape a circular firing squad is to find out what's going on and tell everybody else. And this is fundamentally, I suppose you could call it philosophy. You know, what's the link between thoughts and things? You know, what is the meaning of life? Is one chapter. Here we are.
Just the one chapter.
You don't want to go overboard.
Just the one chapter. Yeah. Okay.
And then we go on. We go on to lighter stuff, like how come elected governments are unpopular. So we go from the fundamental structure, and it also deals with a lot of stuff about, you know, is the quantum mechanical world different?
That wouldn't make more than a single book. There's not that much in that. I'm surprised you managed to pad it out into one whole book. Meaning of life, quantum mechanics.
The great thing is that it gets awful simple if you don't mention anybody. Uh-huh. I mean, everyone always approaches these things by saying Descartes said this and Kant said that, you know, whatever. And immediately your head starts spinning and you've got no idea what's going on. And there is only one or two references to anyone. I've tried to get rid of them all. But once or twice I have to say, well, look, everyone else has had this idea beforehand, so I'm not saying anything new. But apart from that, I don't think there's a single philosopher referenced in the whole book. Quite deliberately, because when I studied philosophy, I arrived at Oxford to study philosophy, and they taught me history. I wanted to answer these big questions, not learn what the wonderful David Hume had to say about them. Great though his thoughts were, we've all moved on. That was 200 years ago. But no, it was, you know, sort of, right, Locke, Berkeley and Hume, and meanwhile we'll learn a little bit about Wittgenstein or something. Just why? This is history of philosophy.
It's all David Icke now.
The thing is that if you look at someone like Kant, he was a contemporary of Lavoisier.
Yeah.
And Lavoisier is a man who named oxygen and did a fantastic job. In fact, actually, it was very largely his wife, which he was always proud to acknowledge. She was the main person because he was out.
And what's her name?
Madame Lavoisier.
I've forgotten what her maiden name was, unfortunately.
Well, you see, I thought you were doing so well, you were being woke. I had to call you out.
He did promote her quite a lot, but the organisations that were around at the time didn't.
Mm. What I was making the point is that nobody in chemistry starts talking about Lavoisier's view of oxygen. Mm. And yet the people in philosophy will carry on talking about Kant.
So let's just deal with the ideas.
Yes, that's right. You know, what is the world out there the way we think it is? You know, and how do we know? Right, that can knock that one off in 15 pages. No probs.
So have you ever considered having acolytes, devotees? I'm thinking, what's the religious word for fans?
Cult,
yeah, cult. So you could be a cult leader. And people could come to you and, you know, be in Rhodes like, some Bhagwan type person.
No, I think it's almost the opposite, because I do believe that the clear view means that life gets very simple. If you know, or you got a fairly good grip on what exists and what doesn't exist, and where right and wrong come from, and fairly simple ideas, then you get rid of an awful lot of clutter. Right and wrong is a very good one, because people have got, you know, God gave the right and wrong and so on. But actually, you can see that it emerges like language does. No one does it. No one's created English. We've done it together because we need it to live together. And the same
exactly,
with
yeah.
the laws and the principles, we've created them.
It's a cooperative behaviour, isn't it?
Yeah.
That allows us to
you don't want to be assaulted or have your stuff stolen, so we have to get together, and then you have to obey the rules that you make.
Exactly, yeah.
Right and wrong, this one, I don't have the reference right in front of me, but in beliefs, people talk about cleanliness being next to godliness. And was it Simon Stylites?
Simon Stylites.
Oh, the guy on the pole.
Yeah. He was the guy up the pole, so tell us about him.
Well, this again gets on to anything being believed by Christianity. A lot of early Christians liked filth, dirt. I mean, not sex, in a dirt. Mm. I mean, Jerome actually told his followers to tiptoe over through puddles so they didn't wash their feet, you know. And Simon Stylites was famous for taking this to a great extent. He built a pillar and lived on top of it, on a little platform, which is about a metre square. And every year he'd come down just once and then put another stone in his pillar and then go back on top of it. And he was so holy, he refused to pick the lice off himself. I mean, this... And people just came from far and wide.
And he used to throw him up food and keep him alive.
Yeah, and he had many, many imitators. Now, you can read the Gospels and the letters to St. Paul, and I cannot find anywhere where you could say that being covered in dirt was in any way good. But there we are.
Do you find that, because you said that you were living in Shanghai for a number of years and you're now in Hong Kong, does that mean that you write differently?
You get a much more worldly view and a better perspective. I mean, you know, we were talking earlier on about how when you're sitting in Hong Kong, as I am now, looking at people bickering about Brexit, you're going, I've got a border with China there, which is a real border. I mean, it still is very much a real border, and it's literally 17 miles from my house, and that's the end of Hong Kong, and everywhere else has got borders. But, you know, we're trading like mad, you know, it all does very well. Living there gives you, we talked about earlier on about how it gave an insight into why didn't the Industrial Revolution happen there. But it also makes you think a lot about Europeans. We have some funny habits, we Europeans, which the Chinese don't have.
I can't.
Well, the most interesting one to me is we have this thing called a conscience. We somehow or other think that there's a God, you know. Well, Stephen, you were saying you're a happy atheist or whatever, but we all think there's a guardian angel, somehow or other, counting our naughty deeds. So we feel ashamed of things when we lie or we've done something wrong. Even when we're not caught. I mean, obviously, when we're caught, we're a bit irritated. Now, genuinely, the Chinese do not have this. You know, if they're caught lying, they're ticked off about it, but they go to their friend, oh, bloody hell, caught me lying, you know? And they're not in any way embarrassed, because why would you be?
Is that conditioning, though? Is that conditioning? Because, I mean, even though I am...
Our conditioning.
Even though I'm not a religious person, my parents weren't particularly religious, you know, my school was very much, you know, sort of right and wrong.
You're
and
kind
you shouldn't
of
do this, and
media.
You should feel shame. And of course, the great British state of being is to be apologetic. I mean, there's those famous experiments where a researcher got people to bump into strangers. And if the stranger was British, they would apologise, even though they were the person who'd been bumped into. It's kind of built into our national psyche, isn't it?
I believe it is very much conditioning. Yeah. And it's a European, and I'm sure it comes from Christianity. That's when people talk about the Christian legacy, the most important thing is this idea
guilt.
That, you know, you're going to account for yourself
yeah,
at the
yeah.
end. And, you know, you better, you sooner or later we find out. As I say, you only subserve that when you go to China and people are not even faintly embarrassed.
What do you like reading? So you're obviously writing a lot. What do you read? We like talking about reading. Do you read?
Oh, as much as I can. And for, I have a problem with fiction because it's not true. So I tried.
It's kind of what it means.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you're thinking, oh, this didn't happen. So it tends to be a lot of...
well, that's the same with a lot of non-fiction too, I suppose.
Ooh.
Unfortunately, I think you're right. But at the moment, I'm reading A History of the English Army, or British Army, I mean.
Who's that by?
The Making of the British Army by Alan Mallinson. Very, very well written, as far as I've got.
Although he has padded it out quite a lot. I see it's a bit of a brick there. Yeah. You could squeeze that down to size, I'm sure.
Yeah, 12 pages.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And I'm also reading a new history of the Bible that's come out, which is good, but lengthy, very, very lengthy. Those are the sort of things that, I don't know, frightfully boring things. My business partner once said to me, "Where do you get those books from?"
It's in the dull section in the library.
Yeah, exactly.
The very large and dull book section.
When you are writing, where do you do it? How do you do it? What's happening around you when you're doing it?
Well, both books are absolute products of the internet. They couldn't possibly have been written, and they are products of our age because you can go and check things, you can go and look things. And, you know, if I sit there going something, say, well, Aristotle said this. Oh, God, did he really say this? And then you can check it up, and you can check it up from three or four sources. And you can look up references. I mean, so these, I do think, we're talking about writing about big subjects. And you and Steve were talking about the fact that you don't need to learn any facts now because you can just simply get them.
Mm.
These are derived very much from the internet, and I think that does enable a sort of big picture without necessarily being at a university with a library.
So, Jamie, as you've looked into the sort of the history of the human race and how we've sort of ended up where we are now, and you've looked at our sort of propensity to follow some form of faith or belief system, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
That's a good question, which is, you know, the usual preamble to I'm not going to answer it, but no, I will answer that one.
He's honest, if nothing else.
As far as material well-being is concerned, I'm very confident that the immense wealth that spread from the first Industrial Revolution, it's spreading out. It came out from Northwest Europe, then went to America, and will gradually drive out the remaining bits of poverty. And with it, you know, we'll all be healthy. I can't see any disease being a problem in future. And there are two things which will be a problem. Firstly, I can't see any reason why we should continue to die. There's no law that says we can't fix that. And that's going to be a problem. I'm not entirely sure how we resolve that. But it is often said now that the first person to live for 1,000 years is alive today. Because then population is not going to be a problem at our current rules because the population growth is shrinking all the time. So it's going to peak at about 11 billion and we can handle that. But if people stop dying, big issue.
Colonise the universe.
Well, that is genuinely going to be... that's beyond our technology unless something else happens. Mm. So that's the first thing. And then the other thing is this whole issue that we were discussing earlier. If people are all warm and contented and bored, then what happens? I don't know. I mean, does it matter if the 100-metre record is 1,000 years old? You know, as is the record for eating chilies or something, that everywhere you go has got. I mean, one of the reasons I love going to India is that there are no supermarkets. It's the only place go to some West Indies island and find yourself pushing a trolley down an aisle, thinking, well, and this is certainly true in the boondocks of China. You know, there you are in Tibet. You know, up the place called that's changed its name to Shangri-La to try and attract things, and you're going through an industrial estate past a brewery, thinking, this is really not as diverse as I thought it was.
Not the Shangri-La, I imagined. Yeah.
Well, the Shangri-La lager is actually quite okay. Yeah. As it turns out.
Yeah, typical.
But it's interesting that
not distinctive, but nice.
Back in the 60s, when I was a young lad, a youngish lad, the utopian view of the future was that robots would be doing everything, this would happen, blah blah, and we'd all have lots more leisure time.
We will.
And that does seem to be coming on track. But those books always play that we would have that leisure time, but we'd all be presumably sufficiently rich or catered for that we wouldn't have to worry about where we're going to get food from, or we wouldn't have to worry about boredom, and we wouldn't have to worry about, you know, our health and that sort of thing. And I those things are sort of lagging behind the amount of leisure time we're getting.
I don't know if you've known people who've come from very, very, very wealthy families. I've known a few, and it's incredibly destructive for the young people because no point in doing anything. That's kind of what happens. Or it seems to, when you don't have the kind of imperative. And in my bad moments, I think we're going through the start of that process.
That's the flip side of your answer then.
Well, yeah. I mean, I do see it in people who've taken early retirement or people who've retired sort of in their late 50s and 60s. If they don't have something that really occupies them, they just seem to wither away and just die. You know, they seem to have... It's something about that need to have a purpose, something that... Not necessarily getting up and going to work every day, but you know, knowing that you have to. There is something about the human psyche, I think, that we all feel we need to have a purpose. We need to be doing something, and the idea that we've got sort of almost enforced idleness because there's nothing to do is terrifying.
I think you're so right, because I mean, there's few experiences in my life quite to equal taking your child to university and dropping them off because you're no longer needed. You might be loved or whatever, but you're no longer needed. They don't need you anymore. And if you're not needed, well, you know, that's kind of a bit of a blow, really.
What
are we doing around here? But
before all the medicine and everything else, of course, chances are you'd be dead at 35 anyway.
Well, that's true.
You know, that was it. You know, you've achieved your purpose. You've created the next generation. They don't need you anymore. You're now redundant. But
this goes back. Now, there's a nice quote somewhere about... you know, people who long for eternal life, who don't know what to do with themselves on a wet Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Read a book.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's the answer. Read a book. Lots of good books to be read.
At some point, I have to say, you know, after the first 100 years.
Well, you can always go for a walk every 100 years and then go back to reading.
Absolutely.
So I do, I mean, and that, the thing is that that's not kidding either. I mean, that is, everything that we see shows material progress. People worry about natural resources, but they say, well, what natural resources are used up? I mean, we don't use up copper or anything like that. Now, we do use energy, but there's massive it pouring in, and, you know, we're getting better at getting that. It doesn't seem likely to be that's going to be a problem. So you're going to get a situation where we have a stable population in 50 years' time, universal kind of wealth, you know, such as we have in the West. That's not to say that, you know, there will be less... misery, because there will be less disease and hopefully better ability to control our mental problems. And then what are you going to do?
It comes back, we're going full circle now to the beginning of the show. We're talking about the way that Victorians and people like this were sort of, they believed they could do anything. I find it extraordinary how we've changed from the 60s, where it's, we're going to the moon, to now, oh, look at all that money they're spending on space research, all that money they're doing this, all that. It seems to be sometimes the accountants have taken over the asylum, and the only measure of something's worth now is how much it's worth, if you know what I mean.
It's that imagination,
is that spirit of adventure seems to be lacking.
Well, there's another thing that you get from living in China, which is very noticeable, and that is luxury goods. I mean, they're just, you know, in Shanghai, there are two roads, Nanjing Road and Huahailu. which are just, you know, you've got Cartier shop followed by a Gucci shop followed by yet another Cartier shop. I mean, they're amazing. And literally, there's one place I can stand just near the flat. We've just given up having a flat in Shanghai, where there's a Rolex shop, in two Rolex shops in the same view. You know, from a standing point of trying to work out why you'd want two. You don't want to show off.
That's one for each wrist.
But the thing is that what's so fascinating to me is that what they're doing now is they're buying these things, and yet a watch is a watch is a watch. And it's very interesting. It's just that there's nothing left except purely the sort of
indulgence. Do you
call it snobbery or indulgence? Yeah. I mean, and in Hong Kong, you get McLarens followed by Ferraris, followed by Lamborghinis, followed by Porsches. The place is 60 miles and it's crossing its biggest.
I know.
I mean, it's just, it's, you know, these are just things people have. And I guess that gives some chance for people to be ambitious, but it seems at the end that has to be a sort of fairly empty kind of feeling, don't you think?
Mm. Okay. So, Jamie, we need a competition. We have a competition every week, and the person who wins this will win a copy of one of your books. So, what do you think is a good question to ask them?
What's the best religion?
That's not a good question. That's not a good question.
Well, what about, what is the biggest topic you can write about? What is the biggest subject you could possibly have for your book?
Wow. In terms of complexity or ending up with the biggest book?
I don't know. Well, you know, so, this one is about whatever it is.
Okay, so what is the biggest topic you could possibly write about?
And I'm looking forward to finding out how we're possibly going to judge the answer to that.
I think we're going to have to be subjective on this.
We might have to refer to Jamie.
Well, I think we might have to. But how do people get in contact with us? How do they send us their competition entry?
They email us at weedlikeaword@gmail.com. However...
Yeah, no, we can't use an apostrophe. This is the frustration of when programmers don't think about grammarians. So it's actually wedlikeaword@gmail.com.
So wedlikeaword@gmail.com. Look forward to hearing from you.
And tell us what you think the biggest possible subject to write about is.
Or other topics as well that you think we should be covering on the programme.
Oh, yeah.
On the podcast.
We'd like to hear from you anyway.
Yeah, you can just say hello, how are you doing? Or suggest people who want to come on, or maybe you want to come on yourself.
Yeah.
Or if you're sick of hearing about something, I wish you'd stop doing such and such a thing.
Books.
Yeah. No, stop talking about books.
Yeah. Talk about something else for a change. Well, we will talk about something else.
Talk about Atari games that were really big in the 80s.
I feel we're coming towards the end.
I think we are, yes. Do you want to wrap up?
Thank you very much for listening to We'd Like a Word. I've been Paul Waters.
And I've been Stephen Colgan.
And thank you very much, Jamie Cawley, for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys. It's been a great pleasure.
We'll talk to you next time when our guest will be... Ha, ha, ha. You'll have to wait and see.
Indeed. Bye-bye.
Until the next time, you've been listening to We'd Like a Word.